listen to that. It started already. Hurry up, would you? That's a mighty tune. Welcome, listeners, to this, the fourth programme in the ICR Headland New Media production of Rambling House. With us again are the Rambling reporters JP Bradley and Tony McLaughlin. How did things go this week, lads, and where were you?
Well, PG, this time we were in a place called Shandrum, which is outside Buncrana on the road to both Clonmany and Cairndonagh. And we were delighted and even honoured to be in the house of a man who is a legend in his own time as far as music, dancing and storytelling is concerned. He also delights in passing on his vast repertoire and skills to the upcoming generation so as to ensure the continuity of our traditions. That man's Dunny McLaughlin, or White Hara as he's known, and he happens to be a good friend of JP and myself for many years as well, which helped matters.
PG, this venue is always going to be the best of crack, as Dunny McLaughlin's house in Shandrum has been welcoming one and all who have a musical interest for many years now, indeed over generations. And Dunny is always ready with a strong Cead Míle Faillte to all who call, and you're highly over the door when the kettle is boiling and to the talkers of music before you're over the doorstep.
Well, lads, let's go to the Rambling House and hear how things went.
We are in the house of a famous traditional musician, music teacher, music composer, dancer and dance composer, the extremely well-known Dunny McLaughlin. Normally in Ireland you have to die, you have people speak well of you and heap praise on you. But Dunny has managed to become a legend while he is still on this earth, and hopefully will remain so for a long time to come.
In paying tribute to Dunny's contribution to Innie Shone's musical tradition, you must also remember other outstanding fiddle players from the peninsula. From this neck of the woods alone, we have a number of remarkable players such as Liz Doherty, Jimmy Clingan, Johnny O'Donnell, Oliver O'Donnell, Kieran Tourish, Peter McGowan, Michael Rudden, P.V. O'Donnell, and of course Pat Mulhern. Further afield, we have the likes of Pat Byrne and Cara Byrne from Malm, Tommy Doherty and Tommy Dornan from Inch, and peppered throughout on his show, we have Neil McColgan, Peter Clark, Neil McGonigal, Neil McColgan, Seamus Grant, Tommy McArdle, and Johnny Graham. To the countless hours of practice they've gone through for our pleasure and enjoyment, we must thank and salute them.
It has been noted that the area's style of fiddle playing is in fact different to the rest of Donegal. Yes, Scotland's had its influence, but it's not as noticeable up here where a more lyrical style is evident, particularly in the reels. This smoother style of playing is in no small part due to the efforts of Mr. Dunny McLaughlin and in turn his teacher, Pat Mulhern. Using little ornamentation, Pat had a rhythm and a swing to his playing that utilises his impressive repertoire of tunes. In time, Dunny became aware of other giants of fiddle playing, namely that of Sligo man Michael Coleman, Northern fiddle player Sean Maguire, and Irish-American fiddle player Andy McCann, a set of whose tunes featured on Dunny's first record, A Rake o' Reels and a Clatter of Jigs, back in 1971.
In her book about Dunny from Barefoot Days, Liz Doherty summarises Dunny's gift very succinctly. Dunny's unique style has thus developed from a myriad of influences near and far. His playing is rhythmic and controlled, clearly articulate yet lyrical. He uses a range of ornamentation including rolls, grace note and trebles, though never excessively, and he displays a natural instinct for variation. Of particular note is his talent for arrangement, for grouping tunes together, and for arranging them in various instrumental combinations. What makes Dunny such a worthy hero of any rambling house is his all-round ability. There'll be a story, a song, a recitation, as well as playing the fiddle, if you ask really nicely. You might even get to witness his party piece of dancing and playing simultaneously. Although it's a wee bit packed here tonight, Dunny, so you're off the hook, I reckon.
You're known the length and breadth of the country as Dunny Whitehara, but it's a name you inherited from your father. Can you throw a bit more light on that one?
My father used to work with this man, Mick Higgerty, in Tinnego, and they each kept a horse and they worked together. So he was getting a harrow made over with Dunny in the big house where the pump is at the moment. And every time you called, the harrow wasn't ready. So Daddy went over the night before and he says, look, we are going to the castle tomorrow in Buncrana to sow corn, and you've got to have the harrow ready. I'll be over at 7:30 in the morning. So, of course, Danny's mother would hear my father giving out, and the harrow was ready in the morning anyhow, but it was White Dame. So when they sowed the corn at the castle, Mick liked to drink, and Daddy told him he could go up to the pub and have a drink. But as long as he saw the white harrow going up and down the field, he could have another pint. But when it stopped going up and down the field, to get back and take home his horse. So Mick was out every 10 minutes or however length of time. I took him to drink a pint and he'd come back in again and he'd say, give us another pint, the white harrow is still moving. So somebody inquired what was this about the white harrow. So my father got that nickname from that day to this.
Very good, very good. Now I know. What age were you when you first played the fiddle?
Well, I wanted to fiddle when I was 6. The first man I heard playing the fiddle was Pat Mulhern. And I remember we had a big night here and my father was waiting on Pat all day and bringing on the dry clods and keeping the fire going. And he questioned my brother several times as to what date he gave him and what time did Pat say he was coming. So he was happy enough with the date and the time, and finally somebody said, there's Pat coming up the lane now. And I ran down to see who this man was that my father was so excited about. It was an ordinary man with this thing under his oxter. So he came in anyhow, and everybody shook hands, and he sat up on a fern there at the big hearth fire where, you know, the crook and the crane and the old things that we had long ago. And he took out the fiddle, and I, first of all, the shape, I thought it was absolutely beautiful. And then when he started to play after the first tune, I thought, God, this must be heaven on earth. And I said, Pat, if I get one of them things, would you teach me to play? No bother, he said. So I says to Daddy, Daddy, will you buy me a fiddle? I'll get you a fiddle tomorrow, son. Well, I waited till I was 14, and I asked every day. It was the longest morrow that ever I come across. He still didn't buy me a fiddle, but he happened to mention that there was an old man lived down the road called Eddie Cadden, and he said they used to run about together, and he was a grand old fiddle player. And I says, will you bring me down till I see him? He says, the first moonlight night. So I was out looking up at the sky every night. Finally, the moon came out. And I came flying in, and I says, Daddy, come on. Come on, what? I says, the moon's out. So what? You promised to take me down to see this old man. Ah, well done, but if I promised, we'd go down. So I never let on. I go down, got on the door, and I saw the fiddle hanging on the nail. And before they got hardly time to say two or three words, I says to the old man, would there be any chance you would loan me that fiddle I'd like to learn to play? And he looked at me and he says, well, damn but seeing you're James' son, I can't very well refuse you. So I lifted down the fiddle under my oxter, and the next night I headed for Patmore, and that's how I started with the fiddle.
That was love at first sight.
Wasn't it? Was definitely love at first sight.
Now, I know from Ranafast, there were certain houses that he had iron up from time to time, and I never really understood why some houses had it and some didn't, and how they knew about it. Or was it on a particular night or something like that? Did you have this here, or was it in the vicinity? Was it this? Was this a rambling house, or were there other houses?
Well, I think maybe the fact that quite a few in our house played music. I had my Aunt Biddy Ann, was a nice singer, and my Aunt Mary played the accordion. Daddy played the accordion and the fiddle. So if there were a house where people played music, that's where they would go, naturally enough, because they would know they'd have music to dance. So it seems there were fairly regular sessions here. I don't know what they called them then. They called them big nights. Just. And then they had bottling nights.
Yes.
They used to have, when they got married, they would come back to the house. And then they would go away for a week, maybe down to Moville. And they thought they were miles away. And then, oh, that's true. That's where my eldest sister, Kitty, got married here. And Pat and Hearn was playing at the wedding. And I just learned a hornpipe called Kitty's Wedding for it. And my father put a big door with a kitchen bed there. And he put a big door on the top of the clothes. And two chairs. And it was the first, maybe the first stage in Ireland where we had the curtains, we could draw them and draw them back. We played there before nobody got near us in the kitchen bed to the people dancing.
But was the bottle night before the wedding?
No. They had the wedding, and then everybody, when the night came, that they were coming home, they would be all out with battles. Every house would be out waiting. And the car would stop, it would be usually maybe if the night was dark. And it would blink the lights three or four times on the top of the drum where everybody could see it. And the first one that saw it lit the battle, and then they all lit battles. And it was lovely. There was fires all over the place. And then they would all come then once the car had arrived in the house. They would all come with a bottle. And they would get a glass, and they would go around and give everybody a glass out of the bottle. And one would be going round after the other. They couldn't wait to get serving the drink quick enough, you know. And in about an hour, they were all full. I suppose. Crack would stick. Maybe there'd be some man out singing in the middle of the floor, and he'd have a half in one hand and a bottle, and then somebody would give him another bottle and he'd grab it with a wee finger and he'd be singing away, and the next thing he would, Johnny Fullerton would spun round, you know, and the next thing the bottle would smash, and then that'd be dried up and everything went, oh, nobody paid any heed.
Well, in Ranafast, they talk about an Eichel Gomagian.
Well, this was...
That was exactly the same here, wasn't it?
The same thing. Yeah. I remember the big nights. I was only about 11 or so, maybe 10. And there was a big fire on. And Susan Kelly would come in, and it was wide sad. You know, God, Mary, should look, your house is lovely. Who whitewashed it? I done it, threw a lock on it today. Where did you buy them curtains, Mary? I bought them in Shams. How much were they? Top and kidney. And I thought, God, this is going to be then. Maybe it'd be well sad you didn't get your turf. God, we lost the pretties of Waters. Terrible. The next thing, Johnny Fullerton was a cousin of my father's, and he's now Bedford Laurie. And you'd hear the rattles of her coming up the lane. She was tied with ropes and wire and baling wire and everything, you see. I said to myself, this is a bit of excitement. And Johnny would open the door and he'd, Christ, he says, is this a wake or what's going on here? And he would just jump out and get pat the bottle, and he would say, I have a wee girl I'm going to take with me. Her dwelling, it comes from the old county down. It breaks my fond heart for to leave her behind me, for with her I'd wander the whole world around. Come away to this country, me bonny wee lassie. Bid adieu to old Ireland and then come with me, where we will live happy and be our own masters in the land of the plenty called sweet liberty. And there'd be somebody called Good Johnny Razor. So that was the party started away the way.
Dermot, you remember a story from Harry Swan about big nights.
The occasion might have been a wedding, the return to or the going from the home of a neighbour, or else his innate overwhelming sociability that might have induced someone to throw his house open. The scene would be a whitewashed house huddled in the fold between hills, the bog lapping against the back door, and a small river running companionably close by. Invitations were not by printed card, indeed formal invitations were not issued. The very one for some days ahead would seem to bear the news of a big night at so-and-so's. Thus the boys and girls, and many not so young, would come on the set night after their labours in the fields and in the home. None was excluded, not the stranger certainly, if he should chance that way. Until the crowd gathered, the early arrivals sat quietly talking about fairs, crops and the weather. The young people of the house, however, were itching to be at it, and as the crowd thickened, they seemed to be growing restive. Presently, amid a burst of applause, the melodeon player, who had of his limited circle enjoyed the popularity of a famous band leader, comes on. The kitchen table has already been pulled back, and after a false start, perhaps on the part of the player, the music begins. Soon the kitchen is alive with movement. Those not dancing shrink back against the wall, and their elders have reserved an oasis of peace at the far end near the fire. While the dance is in progress, to make an exit is akin to the crossing of a busy street. Lucky that the dresser, studded with shining delf, is set solidly against the wall. Between dances, people are called out for a song. In the close communal life which is lived in these remote places, it is well known whether we sing well or ill, and the song to which we are partial is also known. The song, or song, comes to be associated with us like a physical characteristic. Obeying the conventions, we protest reluctantly to allow ourselves to be persuaded, and all present know that we should. We listen in polite silence until the last few lines, when another convention compels us to stop singing and mutter our way hurriedly to the end. So the night wears on with song and dance and recitation. To quote Wordsworth, the valley rings with mirth and joy, the songs of the freshness and vividness of the old ballads, which fundamentally they are. Among the mountains we do not cheapen the moon or nature by crooning about them. Many have reference to the emigration which formed the uneasy background to life in these parts. Some bear witness to our many and close links with Scotland. The recitations have, for their themes, mostly political incidents with narrowly local appeal. Presumably, these recitations were never committed to a paper, but provide an example of oral transference from one generation to another. The stranger will, we venture to think, be struck by the spontaneity which we have amused ourselves. Indeed we are, as and more important matters than this, a company to rely upon our own resources, upon the native vigour which urban life tends to atrophy. Consider, the only mechanical equipment employed has been a cheap melodeon. But alas, these big nights are disappearing and will soon be but relics of a past age, serving to awaken a nostalgia for the old times. The homeliness of those good-natured gatherings cannot compete against the glitter of the towns. Thank you.
What's the name of that first tune again?
The Salem Command.
Where does that come from?
There's two tunes that I composed.
Oh, right, yes.
On the Salem Command, there's a girl wrote a poem about it, just in that book there.
I see.
She was at the session one night, and she was, you know how we would nod to her, when we were changing. She was watching, she didn't know what was going on, so she called it the Salem Command.
Really good.
Another one actually was named by Adele McLaughlin here. I don't have a name for the second gig. And I just got the new suite. And she was pressing the thing, you know, the
recliner.
And she said, just call it the cozy suite.
The cozy suite, very good. What would you consider the main ingredients of any show on traditional music? Is that a difficult question? Is there something unique about any show?
Everything about any show is unique. We're very, very special. Well, I suppose you talked about Johnny Doherty there. It would have had a Scotch influence way back, and as he was saying in the, when he was talking there earlier on, when I heard Michael Coleman and Andy McGann, I realised that we were missing something, you know, and I set about just listening very carefully to hear what they were doing, you know.
Yes.
And they discovered there were more ornamentation than we were using, you know.
Yes.
And different wee things that I picked up. So when I sort of learned all as much as I could pick up about the real tradition, that's what I call that, and then I sort of passed it on to my pupils, which means that they have a good grip of the tradition. And it was sort of proved when they went to the All-Ireland, came back, you know, All-Ireland champions, that there was no difference. They couldn't...
You were fully vindicated.
I was happy then. I said, that's it now. They can't say we're not top in the traditional section.
We're talking about ornamentation. Like, some people think it's very excessive. Like Martin Hayes, for example. I know some Donegal fiddle players who do not like his style. Yeah. I happen to like it myself.
It's ornamentations, it's just the way slides. But you're going to get people to criticise good players no matter who
they
are.
They do,
and quite a lot of it, I think, is just jealousy. When I hear a good player, I'd be delighted. Like there's Sean McGuire, one of the tops.
Yes.
And I mean, you'll get fiddle players criticising him, and they could no more and make an attempt at playing what he's doing, you know.
Well, if you met a young person who wanted to be a fiddle player, like yourself, I mean, what would be the key elements that would make that person into a good fiddle player, do you think?
Well, like everything else, if you learn how to hold your instrument properly, and watch the tone, finger work, tuning, the bow is very important, that they learn to bow the fiddle properly.
Yes, you were saying that about young Jimmy McBride.
Jimmy came to me when he was about 12.
Yes.
And he was holding the fiddle down on his knee, and he had a grip of the bow like a spade, you know. And I thought, what am I going to do here? He was a very nice young fella. So I started off by telling him and explaining to him that if he held the fiddle up and got the arch of the wrist out and put the fingers down, straight down on the top rather than putting them down flat, because if you put your fingers down flat, you can't produce tone. So when I got that sort of straightened out, then we started on the bow. And Jimmy was no time, you know, I never had anybody that learned so fast, because he had already developed bad habits, and it's very difficult to get out of a bad habit. But I was sent to John, and John says, well, I'll tell you what he did. When he left the class in Buncrana, when you left, he got into the back of the car, and he played till he got up to the border. And coming forward to the border, he got out. And when he passed the border, he got back in again. And he played till he went home, and he says maybe he didn't go to bed at all at night in case he would miss something. So anybody's prepared to put in that amount of practice,